Welcome to the October podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pincham. The October issue is on the topic of advances in endoscopic skull-based surgery. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Ted Schwartz of Weill Cornell Medical College, New York, New York, speaks with Dr. Daniel Prevedello of Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. They discuss Dr. Prevedello and colleagues' article, Immediate Complications Associated with High-Flow Cerebrospinal Fluid Egress During Endoscopic Endonasal Skull-Base Surgery, a report of two cases.
This is Ted Schwartz. I'm one of the editors of the Special Neurosurgical Focus issue on endoscopic skull-based surgery. And I'm very lucky to have with me here today Dr. Dan Prevedello. And I'm going to call him Danny because we go back a long ways and we're good friends. We have several really interesting papers that were accepted for this issue, and a few of them were written by Danny. And I wanted to talk to him about some of those and hash out a few of the details of the papers for the readers. Before I do that, just to say a little bit about Danny. Danny Prevedello really is one of the stars of endoscopic skull-based surgery in the world, not just in the country, but in the world. And having come from Brazil, he really has a fantastic international background and international community that follows his work and appreciates his work, and of course trained not only with Ed Laws in pituitary surgery, but also at Pittsburgh with the group there and is now in Ohio. Welcome, Danny, and thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
I wanted to first talk to you a little bit about your background as to what got you interested in endoscopic skull-based surgery and what it was like making the transition from doing, I would assume, sort of more of a pituitary practice with Dr. Laws to more of a skull-based practice in Pittsburgh and how those two experiences shaped your thinking.
Yeah, that's very interesting. That's the story of my career. It goes actually back when I was trained back in Brazil with João Cândido Araújo. He was my mentor. He came to me and asked what I want to do for my life as a neurosurgeon, and I answered skull base. He was friends with Dr. Laws, and we got the connection there and ended up and stayed with Ed for almost 2 years. And was starting, like at that time, with John Jean Jr., doing some endoscopic cases, but most of them were definitely microscopic at that time. And got in like passion with the endoscope. And when I saw the Minka Sam doing what he was doing with the endoscope and exploring the skull base with that, I felt like the link to everything that I want to do, like really the skull base and utilizing the endonasal passage transsphenoidal. I think that was great. So that's the way I see my practice now, is I do skull base surgery. I'm happy to do what I really want to do as a career. I think it's important that people understand that it's not only endoscopic, that we use the endoscope as one tool, but for many diseases, we still do a microscopic skull-based surgery, traditional with everything that was taught to us by the main pioneers of skull-based surgery. And we just add the endoscope for assisted microsurgery and also for the endoscopic skull-based surgery. So I think it came to really add and for us to do the best we can to take care of our patients, to avoid morbidity, and combining everything. That's basically my practice nowadays.
That's terrific. So that leads in nicely to the first topic I want to talk about, which is starting with the paper on chondrosarcomas, because it's more about the surgery itself, and then we'll get to the paper on CSF leaks, which is more about complications and closures and things like that. Chondrosarcomas, particularly the cases you presented in your series, which are tumors that go into the posterior fossa, that are intradural tumors going to the posterior fossa, those are the ones that even people who are comfortable doing endoscopic skull-based surgery might say, wow, maybe I need to do this one through a far lateral. Maybe I need to do a transpetrals. Maybe I need to come laterally to do this. And in that paper, you really show beautifully that even a lot of the intradural component can be removed endonasally. And so the question I have for you is, of all the chondrosarcomas, let's say, that you've seen over the last, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, have any of them required a microscope? What is the limit of the endoscope in terms of chondrosarcomas, and how has endoscopy changed our management of chondrosarcomas when you can now go intradural and get into the posterior fossa?
That's a very good question. So I think what chondrosarcoma has in particular is the origin of itself, like, which is in the petrochlival synchondrosis. So the fact that it starts on the tetraclivosin chondrosis allows the endoscopic endonasal approach to reach the origin of the tumor. So when the tumor grows to different directions from the tetraclivosin chondrosis, it can reach posterior fossa, it can reach middle fossa, it can go to the neck, and it can go to the sphenoid. By doing these cases and seeing that we can get to the core of the tumor and allowed us to see that you can actually follow the tumor into multiple different directions, including intradural posterior fossa when those that go to the CP angle. So for that paper, my idea was exactly this, to show that this is possible, and not only possible, but I think is the best way to reach the component intradural of the tumor. The reason is because it comes from the bone, and some of these surgeries, when we do the resection, we actually can get a very complete resection, staying completely extradural without creating a spinal fluid leakage. Others, the tumor actually eroded through the dura, but it still started from that point. And then if you follow the tumor intradurally, the cranial nerves and vessels, they're pushed away from your axis. So you can actually follow the tumor and get to these areas, keeping the surgery very safe without creating morbidity. Then, of course, there is a need for microsurgery. In some cases, I think we put it there. Some of the cases, I think there's one that I end up leaving a residual under the 7 and 8 cranial nerves that I couldn't see during surgery. The main limitation I had was the angle of view. I probably missed that area there. Then I came back with a retrosigmoid approach, and I complete the resection with a microscope, with an open approach. But I think the need for a very big surgery, transpetrous approach, lateral approach, to try to get the tetraclivosin chondrosis is more morbid than coming endonasal to access the origin of the tumor in the tetraclivosin chondrosis. So that's why we prefer that as the first angle of access to these tumors. And then if there's residual, then you have to then go from there. There's another patient that we left a little residual around the carotid artery in the neck where the tumor extended into the superior aspect of the cervical area, and we actually then came transoral and performed an incision in the mucosa laterally near the amygdala and the tonsil. So then we went all the way into the tumor, actually resected the rest of the tumor with a transoral approach in a separate stage. Again, I think the endonasal is very good to access the origin of the tumor in the tetraclivosin chondrosis.
Let me ask you a technical question. I assume most of the resection you're doing with a 45-degree scope, a 30-degree scope. What sort of angled instruments do you have that allow you to get out laterally? I don't imagine you can use only straight instruments to get out that far. Can you talk a little about that?
Yeah, that's totally correct. First of all, we try to do most of the work with a zero-degree endoscope. In order to do that, more often we are removing the eustachian tube. Because the eustachian tube is the barrier in the way that if you try to go behind the eustachian tube to go to the jugular foramen, for instance, you end up with the need of constant utilization of angle scopes and angle instruments. Then in those situations, we use angle suctions to kind of try to bend the suction to go there. We do have instruments we designed with angulation to go all the way there, even curettes or dissectors that have an angle. I wish I could show the instrument right now, but it's 45 angle with going even like 1 or 2 inches even away from the bend, so then you can reach further far away. Again, most of the time we try to optimize the utilization of the zero endoscope because it's more straightforward for the surgeons. You see what you're doing and it's less awkward for the movements. So doing a transpterygoid approach, which taking the base of the pterygoid, lateralizing the pterygopalatine fossa is very often necessary. And then often the need for drilling of the medial part of the pterygoid plates and then going posteriorly. And like I said, removing your eustachian tube helps to have a full exposure of the petrous bone or this and the tetraclivosin chondrosis, which is just posterior to the eustachian tube itself. So then when you remove it, you have a better exposure of the tumor in a straight condition. So then you can use a zero-degree endoscope to get at it. You're totally right. Then we augment that with angle scopes, and then angle instrument helps.
So just as a follow-up, morbidity of resecting the eustachian tube in terms of middle ear drainage tubes, things like that?
We don't do anything initially. We follow the patients to see how they do. There is a percentage of the patients that I will not be able to tell you for sure, but I would say that more than half do okay without any need for long-term drainage of the middle ear. I guess they continue draining through the eustachian tube. Some of them, though, probably because of the edema and swelling of the mucous membranes and the station tube where you cut, they require then the installation of a tube in their ears to drain the middle ear. That's the morbidity related to that. There's nothing else that can come out of it. And we always tell the patients, and it's interesting, for some of the chondrosarcomas, the station tube is already impaired. So sometimes they present with a fusion on the mastoid and middle ear already. For those, it's definitely not an issue at all.
And then finally, so closure. Let's say you're in the posterior fossa, and this will lead us into our second conversation, but you've taken out the chondrosarcoma. There's a big CSF leak from the posterior fossa. You got a hole there. What's your go-to closure for that kind of posterior fossa lateral defect?
That's a very good question, because in general, we use a collagen matrix membrane as an inlay material inside the dura to replace the arachnoid area. And then we use very often the nasal septal flap as the main reconstruction barrier. However, on these very lateral ones, when we drill behind the carotid, where we go with the angled drills and drill the petrous bone posterior, and then you have a dural defect behind the petrous bone, for those, very, very often, we put a fat graft as the main component closing the petrous bone. The sequence would be DuraGen or collagen matrix inlay, closing the dura directly, followed by fat graft, and mainly because the flap, nasal septal flap, will not reach in that area anyways. The fat reforms basically the petrous bone, and then return the flap to cover the carotid artery that's often exposed in these cases, and then cover the scoby defect after the fat graft. So it's a combination of those three. And I don't remember having a CSF leak with that type of a reconstruction in my mind right now.
That brings us to our next conversation, which is the risk of a CSF leak. We used to fear CSF leaks, and then we got to the point where CSF leaks were just a natural part of the surgery that we did. We expected it, and we prepared for it. And we weren't as afraid of intraoperative CSF leaks, but more postoperative CSF leaks. But the second paper you wrote talks more about having an intraoperative CSF leak in and of itself can be risky, and we shouldn't take that for granted. It's not just about preventing post-op CSF leaks, but it's also about being mindful of our intraoperative CSF leaks. So can you talk a little bit about what were the factors that made the CSF leaks problematic in these patients compared to the hundreds of other patients that we've all operated on that had big intraoperative CSF leaks that did not have a problem in surgery? What do you think was different about these two cases that can teach the audience something that we need to avoid or think about?
It's very interesting. I agree with you. Most of the time is not an issue at all, and we dissect. Even when it's not through the nose, we do craniotomies and you get CSF removed, and very rarely we have complications related to that. But in these cases, I think there are two aspects that are different in the two cases that happened there. One of the aspects is one of the patients was old, was I think in the 80s, and we had an apoplastic tumor that was going intradural, intraarachnoid, and there was definitely a lot of CSF exposure, and the dissection was a long case, and we got a good resection of the tumor, but definitely there was constant leakage of CSF during the surgery. So I think in that case in particular, the only aspect was that the patient was old and with atrophy, brain atrophy, and probably what happened was a vein that tear and an acute subdural hematoma. The only different aspect in that case was just the fact that the patient is old. So I think in terms for the audience, when you're out there doing these procedures, I think it's very important to have that in consideration, because anytime you have a CSF leak, you have like a movement of the brain because there's less of a support. And if you have somebody with a tendency like a brain atrophy, old lady, there is a possibility of that to happen. I think in that case, we were able to identify there were changes in the somatosensorial evoked potentials, and we did an intraoperative head CT, and we detected that there was that subdural hematoma was happening. And then immediately we talked to the family and opened a craniotomy, evacuate that, and that was not a problem for the patient. So the other patient, the factor that contributed for complication was the constant CSF leak during surgery that was prolonged through a small opening of the dura. So this was a chordoma that after removal of the chordoma, there was a very tiny spot with the leakage of CSF that we actually didn't give importance. So we'll fix it later. And while we spend our time to elevate flaps from the side of the head, because that patient did not have a nasal septal flap available, so we took our time to elevate the flap from a temporoparietal axis and we did not cover that final leakage. We let it leak for the whole time of that harvesting of the reconstruction. And I think that for the audience is the lesson we took there nowadays with more than ever. When there is a leakage, it's okay if you're dissecting. We try to put pledgets and see if it's possible to minimize leakage during surgery. But for long, long cases, if you have the opportunity to cover your defect, I think you should to avoid excessive leakage. Because that patient in a small hole probably had some sort of valve effect where the leak was happening, CSF was coming out, air was going in, and end up with a tense pneumocephalus and posterior fossa bleeding, like a subarachnoid type of bleeding around the folia of the cerebellum. I actually had to almost do a posterior fossa decompression. I was worried that we end up just draining the tense pneumocephalus with a borehole emergently performed after surgery, and patient end up doing very well afterwards. But it was an interesting thing because very scary, like he was not waking up after surgery. And that scenario was definitely because he lost CSF. There was no dissection at all performed intradurally. And was just the fact that he licked CSF in a relatively simple procedure, extradural procedure. We ended up almost losing this gentleman because of CSF leak that happened during the surgery. Those are the main aspects. To summarize, old person in very prolonged intraoperative leakage, particularly in the posterior fossa. I think that's the other thing, is that for that gentleman, the little hole was exactly in the lower aspect of the clive, and that led more CSF to come out.
Those are both great points. We've also had instances just from lumbar drainage in elderly patients of subdural hematomas, and we try not to put in lumbar drains if we have patients who have a lot of brain atrophy. So I would echo what you're saying. Now, question, though, in the elderly patient that you mentioned, was the patient's head of bed elevated? And do you think if the patient's head had been flat during surgery, would they be less likely to tear a bridging vein and develop the subdural hematomas associated with the CSF leak?
That patient, the head was flat, actually. It was not elevated. I tend to elevate slightly most of the time because of the venous drainage, for particularly around the cavernous sinus, to get less tension in the venous system. But that in particular was flat, and I remember that very well because we did that case inside the CT scanner, and the CT scanner cannot elevate the head. So that one definitely wasn't flat. So I don't know. It's probably not very related to that. Maybe she was having a bleeding vein that was ready to rupture and just coincidental. But definitely that forced the situation, the fact that the leakage happens.
So were you able to use the intraoperative CT to identify the subdural?
That was what we did. Yeah, we just stopped right there when the SSCPs changed, and we passed the patient in the scan. So we didn't need to change the patient from any bed. We just turned the head and turned the craniotomy.
If you had not been an intraoperative scanner, do you think she would have survived, or would have this been a lethal event?
That's a very good question. I think it will be okay because it was still not a very large subdural hematoma. Those very interested, the picture is in the paper. But it will be probably something more stressful because you will need to run with the patient to the CT, get to then bring back to the operating room. I think it still will be in time. I think it will still be okay, but definitely much more like stressful situation. Having intraoperative CT, I think, is helpful for these rare cases.
I think that's all great, great information for our listeners and certainly helped me understand both of those papers in more detail. And as the field evolves, I think we'll be finding more and more of these unexpected events in high-volume centers that can help all of us do this surgery more safely. So I thank you very much, Danny.
Thanks so much. I appreciate that. Very good talking to you, and I hope to see you soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
This concludes our podcast for the October issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the November issue, when the topic will be Neurosurgery and Health Economics. Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. And for more information on how to submit your research to the Journal of Neurosurgery, please visit thejns.org and click on Info for Authors.